when I heard about this story of a convenience store clerk, a Muslim immigrant from Bangladesh, shot by a white supremacist in Texas after 9/11, and then the immigrant 10 years later forgives his attacker, the deeper I got into this story, which kind of just intrigued me, I realized that it was a collision between these two Americas.
Reza Bouillon survived the attack. He's the person who remade himself, as you tell the story in this book. But he'd already remade himself, coming from anything but humble origins in Bangladesh. I mean, he had a terrific career, but just no way to practice it. And he had to humble himself to do what he ended up doing as a convenience store clerk in the United States.
You know, I remember I once read a book about how there's a gene that you often find in people who do bungee jumping and other crazy things. And the book made the argument that Americans had the highest kind of proportion of this gene in the population than any other country in the world. Because America is full of these people or descendants of people who maybe have perfectly good situations, as Race did. An Air Force officer in his country. He was never going to drive his own car. He was going to be chauffeured around for the rest of his life. He was going to have country club memberships, be a senior military officer, be at the height of respect. But something in him, that kind of bungee jumping gene, let's call it, always wanted more than whatever he had. Not in a selfish, acquisitive way, but wanted more and more in his case, as in so many people's cases around the world, meant America.
Bungee jumping in Dallas and coming face to face with Mark Stroman, who, for many people in the world, despite America's reputation as being a place where you can remake yourself, Mark Stroman is also the image of America around the world. Where does that image come from and where does it fit in this story?
In many ways, Mark Stroman is an aberration. I mean, he's a, you know, anybody who walks into three gas stations as he did and shoots three people is very much his own situation. But at a deeper level, I think it would be wrong to see him only as an aberration because he did grow out of a context. And in many ways, that's a context of a white working class in particular that economically, culturally, was in many ways the backbone of this country. When you look at movies and music, we still think of this kind of semi-rural, ex-urban white America as kind of the heartland. And in a great many places, that heartland is failing, falling apart. And he grew out of that heartland that is failing and falling apart.
What was it like to hang with the Stromans?
It was very interesting. At first, they were skeptical of whether me, a kind of brown-skinned outsider from New York City, I'm not sure what was worse, being brown-skinned or from New York City, whether I would kind of tell their story honestly and faithfully, and whether I was, as one of them asked me, are you over here to tell this story because you're from over there too? And I first said no. And then I said, you know what, that's maybe in some deeper way I am. I don't know.
What rocked your world or appalled you about the life that Mark Stroman came from?
It's not just Mark Stroman. It's the life his kids are now living. It's the life everybody he knows. One of the funny things was, not funny, but you know, there are several thousand pages of legal documents that come out of any capital murder trial, which is what he had. And they're just a bunch of names from his childhood of his friends sprinkled into this long record, people he was arrested for, you know, driving around in someone else's pickup truck with when he was 12 and little things like that. And almost any name I ran through the internet was also a violent criminal later convicted of very, very serious crimes. Mm-hmm. So if you were hanging, if you were in his social world and hanging with him when you were 12, it was a pretty done deal that you were going to end up being a violent criminal. So what blew my mind was that this is a social universe. And again, we have this feeling about the inner city and the Bronx and whatever. This is white, ex-urban America. And you have a social structure that is completely in tatters. You have, in some cases, a lack of work, although Mark Stroman never had that problem. The word family, which we all continue to use as though nothing has changed, nobody in that world has a family. Now, this is something where we don't talk about it in America because the left doesn't want to talk about it for one set of reasons. The right only wants to talk about it in one very narrow way. And so we just agree not to talk about it.
The prosecutors in the Stroman case went out of their way to get the death penalty and really almost ideologically made the point that this is not America. This trial for them was about his hatred is not America. And so therefore, they sought the death penalty. Do you agree with that?
In his case, the notion that there's only one idea of America is obviously an absurd idea. And part of what was so beautiful about what the prosecutors argued was that Mark Stroman, who called himself the true American, was, you know, a false prophet of the idea of a true American, and that it was these immigrants who loved America enough, as the prosecutor said, to leave where they were and come here, to choose it, not just inherit it, who also embodied a certain true American spirit. But I have to say, part of why I wrote this book and called it The True American is because I don't think it's so straightforward what a true American is. One of these characters may be a lot more likable than the other, but in some ways these are two deep veins of thinking in America, and one has to do with kind of preserving your culture and keeping things as they are, and another has to do with constant churn. And I actually think part of what makes America great, independent of these two particular men, is getting that balance right between how much you change and how much you keep.
Do you think Reis Bouillon, in the end, as part of his forgiveness, could see the pain that Mark Stroman was in this world that you investigated as a journalist, and could see that his dreams weren't being realized and that he could really relate to that?
He did. And you know, in his own life, he spent a lot of time thinking about what he could do. First, he came to the conclusion on a pilgrimage to Mecca that God had saved him and he needed to repay God. But it took him time to figure out how. And his conclusion was, his way of intervening as a kind of Muslim immigrant in America was to say, not only do I not hate the person who did this to me, who left me blind in one eye, who left 39 pellets in my face forever, not only do I not hate you, I forgive you. I understand that you had a very limited opportunity to become anything other than what you became. And towards the end of this story, in what is truly, for me, one of the most remarkable twists, Reis Bouillon starts to invest money and time in Mark Stroman's children and decides that he doesn't want to just save Mark Stroman. He wants to invest in that family and see if he can help at least one American family get out of this cycle of poverty and ignorance and hatred and self-hatred.
I sense in this book your voice, that you're really fighting to make sure people get it about what you're talking about here. What's your fight in this book?
I will say unambiguously that this is the most extraordinary country in the world, but there's a great number of us in this country, right alongside the rest of us, who are already living in second and third world conditions. And this duality of a country that still manages to be world-beating in so much that it does and still manages to have so many people who are living that way and cannot figure out how to connect them, connect that promise and capacity and hope to all the people who are no longer living that way. That's my fight.
Anand Giridharadas, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
He's the author of The True American: Murder and Mercy in Texas and is a columnist for our partner, The New York Times.
I'm David Remnick, host of The New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.